listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skulls in a pool of cerebral spinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Didn't history already happen? Part 2. Last time, I explained why I think the study of history is important for everyone, and that if you do it right, it's also fun. I also pointed out that written records are valuable, but flawed. Today I'll talk about other sources of information regarding humanity's past, specifically those provided by science. The first scientific discipline to help fill in the gaps of our knowledge of history was archaeology. Archaeology gives us lots of information about the past. One advantage of archaeological evidence is that, unlike many written records, it doesn't have an agenda. It simply is what it is. Carbon-14 and potassium-argon dating, along with methods like stratigraphy and dendrochronology, give us hard data on the age of many recovered artifacts. Where the never-ending supply of human fallibility comes into play with such evidence is in how it is interpreted. What's the purpose of the object that was dug up? Is it ceremonial or for practical use? In what context was it found? What does it tell us about the people who used it? Such questions are standard subjects of debate among archaeologists. Debate is good. That's part of science's self-correcting mechanism, an inoculation against the weaknesses of the quirky human brain. It helps good interpretations survive, and bad ones to be shot down. But archaeologists agree in many more cases than those in which they disagree, and such consensus helps us check against written records to see what matches up and what doesn't. Speaking of archaeology, one thing it revealed to us as martial artists comes from paintings on the walls of ancient Egyptian tombs. One great example is the tomb at Beni Hassan from about 4,000 years ago. The wall paintings there are a virtual graphic manual on grappling. A whole array of pictures depicts techniques that are pretty sophisticated for such an early civilization, including arm bars, arm drags, and tackles, being practiced at a time when most of the rest of humanity was still using stone tools. This is powerful evidence that the martial arts are not solely Asian in origin. Another area of science that helps us fill in the gaps in the record is genetics. Here's something you may not have known. In a way, we each have more than just one single genetic signature. Women each have two, and men each have three. First, we each have our regular DNA structure, called the nuclear DNA, half of which we inherited from our father and half from our mother. That half-and-half mix means that each person's DNA signature is a unique combination of traits. But we all each have at least a second set of genes. How's that possible? The culprit is a tiny organelle that exists in nearly every cell in the human body, and for that matter, in the bodies of nearly all other complex organisms on the planet. These organelles are called mitochondria, and they are a huge part of our metabolism. To put it simply, mitochondria are the energy source for our cells. Now here's the weird, cool part. If you go back in time, way back, almost 2 billion years, our single-cell ancestors didn't have mitochondria. And then later, they did. The most prevalent hypothesis regarding how we got them is that they were originally a separate species of organism that competed with our ancestor organisms for resources. Somewhere along the line, our ancestor organisms developed a symbiotic relationship with the mitochondria, actually absorbing them inside their cell walls, where they remain to this day. They give us energy, and our cell walls give them shelter. But despite the fact that they are now part of us, mitochondria have retained their own DNA. For each of us, this is called mitochondrial DNA, and it's separate and different from our regular nuclear DNA. Here's another weird part. You inherit your mitochondrial DNA only from your mother. Your father contributes nothing. This means that unlike your regular nuclear DNA, which is shuffled each generation like a deck of cards, your mitochondrial DNA remains unchanged from generation to generation, passing from mother to child over and over again in an unbroken chain, in some cases for thousands of years. Why is that important for filling in the gaps of history? The one thing that does cause change in mitochondrial DNA is random mutation, which happens very seldom, often only once in about every 10,000 years. Every time a mutation happens in a woman's mitochondrial DNA, if she has children, she becomes the founder of a new scientifically identifiable line of people. This new line, as well as the old line, is called a haplogroup. The number of mitochondrial DNA haplogroups among humans is small enough that we can use it to answer a lot of questions about prehistoric humanity. For example, all currently existing mitochondrial DNA haplogroups stem from a single one, from a woman that scientists think lived roughly between 100,000 and 200,000 years ago. She is sometimes referred to, unfortunately, as mitochondrial Eve. I say unfortunately because this name creates several misconceptions. The first is that she was the only woman alive on the planet. That's not true, and that's not the reason that only her matrilineal descendants survive. Instead, it simply means that the descendants of the other women who were alive during her lifetime have not survived until today, a phenomenon called genetic drift. Because of this lack of understanding of genetic drift, another misconception about mitochondrial Eve is that she constitutes evidence in support of young Earth creationism. She does not. But mitochondrial DNA haplogroups do tell us a lot. When you look at human haplogroups laid out on a world map, it answers a lot of questions. And, like any good scientific discovery worth its salt, raises new ones. Another thing that mitochondrial DNA taught us is that nearly all people of European descent, that's science talk for white folks, are divided into only 8 haplogroups, which further means that we palefaces are each descended from one of only 8 women. By the way, it's important to point out that you shouldn't read more into a haplogroup than is appropriate. It is an indelible marker of descent from mother to child. It does not say anything about the intelligence, appearance, fitness for survival, or anything else about members of the haplogroup. In addition to regular issue DNA and mitochondrial DNA, male humans have a third genetic signature, Y chromosome DNA. Its existence creates yet another set of haplogroups among humans, distinguished by a genetic marker that is only passed along from fathers to sons. This gives us even more information about prehistoric humans and allows us to cross-check mitochondrial DNA haplogroups against Y chromosome DNA haplogroups to get even more granular information. Now, I know that's a lot of sciencey-sounding talk, but this is literally archaeology within our own bodies. How cool is that? Using this very recent data, we're now fairly certain that modern humans arose as a species in Africa a few 100,000 years ago. And then roughly 70,000 years ago, some of them moved out into Asia. The rest stayed behind in Africa. Archaeological evidence strongly supports the hypothesis that they relied heavily on a seafood diet. In any case, the location of fossil remains suggests that they tended to stay close to the shoreline as they migrated. They gradually spread east across the south coast of Asia. Sometime around 50 or 60,000 years ago, some of them made it to Australia. and then some others turned north to make their way into East Asia. Much later, roughly 40,000 years ago, some of them finally had doubled back to Europe. And about 15,000 years ago, some others of them made it across the land bridge between Northeast Asia and North America. While Australia and the Americas were uninhabited by humans when these folks got there, Asia and Europe were already inhabited by at least two other species of humans. Now, we tend to think of one species of humans evolving into the next species, at which point the earlier species politely dies off. It's hard for us to imagine a world in which more than one species of humans lives at the same time. Like J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth, which was populated by humans, elves, dwarves, and orcs, Eurasia at that time was inhabited by the newly arrived modern humans, as well as two archaic human species that we know of, our cousins, the Neanderthals, and an only recently discovered species that split off from Neanderthals 600,000 years before, called the Denisovans. Both of these archaic species are now extinct. Or are they? For more than a century, since the first discovery of Neanderthal fossil remains in the Neander Valley in Germany, debate about what killed off this archaic species has gone on among anthropologists. At first, it was thought that modern humans must have employed violence to kill off their less intelligent archaic cousins. Then it was hypothesized that modern humans were simply better adapted for the changing conditions of Ice Age and post-Ice Age Eurasia. They outcompeted the Neanderthals for resources, and the archaic species withered on the vine and died off. But we have now analyzed the genome of modern humans, Neanderthals, and Denisovans. It turns out that present-day humans, with the exception of Africans, get 1-4% of their DNA from the Neanderthals. So the next time you run into a Nazi, tell him that black Africans are the only racially pure humans on the planet, and then smile serenely and watch for the reaction. In addition to their Neanderthal genes, about 5% of the DNA of Australian Aborigines and the people of Melanesia, recent DNA studies reveal, comes from the Denisovans. Which all goes to show that humans will hit anything that moves. But, seriously, all this means that, in one sense, these two archaic species of humans live on, in most of us. We are mutts, as it turns out. As a martial artist, though, I'm still intrigued with what combat with a Neanderthal or a Denisovan would have been like. Imagine squaring off with a guy that's built like an NFL linebacker, carrying a stone-tipped spear with a long, thick haft. So, when you think of the study of history as old-fashioned, as poring over dusty old books to learn about things that someone wrote down a long time ago, keep this point in mind. Through the use of recent scientific discoveries, everything I've discussed in today's episode was only learned in the last decade or two, and the learning curve is climbing fast. The few things I discussed today are only a very tiny part of the things that have been discovered about history in recent decades. I don't know about you, but I think that's really cool. Next time, I'm going to take you to Rome in the Classical Age for a very deep dive into a specific case of how science has recently revealed secrets about the past. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out old episodes of the Martial Brain podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions, in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or about the Rising Phoenix Academy at my website, rpmartialarts.com.